Galt accompanied him to the door, then came back, sat down at the table, and in a leisurely manner reached for another cup of coffee. She shot to her feet as if flung by a jet of pressure breaking a safety valve. "Do you think that I'll ever accept his money?" He waited until the curving streak of coffee had filled his cup, then glanced up at her and answered, "Yes, I think so." "Well, I won't. I won't let him risk his life for it." "You have no choice about that."
"I have the choice never to claim it."
"Yes, you have." "Then it will lie in that bank till doomsday." "No, it won't. If you don't claim it, some part of it, a very small part, will be turned over to me in your name."
"In my name? Why?"
"To pay for your room and board." She stared at him, her look of anger switching to bewilderment, then dropped slowly back on her chair. He smiled. "How long did you think you were going to stay here, Miss Taggart?" He saw her startled look of helplessness. "You haven't thought of it?"
"I have."
"You're going to stay here for a month, for the 1 month of our vacation, like the rest of us. I'm not asking for your consent. You did not ask for ours when you came here. You broke our rules, so you'll have to take the consequences. Nobody leaves the valley during this month. I could let you go, of course, but I won't. There's no rule demanding that I hold you, but by forcing your way here, you've given me the right to any choice I make, and I'm going to hold you simply because I want you here. If at the end of a month you decide that you wish to go back, you will be free to do so. Not until then." She sat straight, the planes of her face relaxed, the shape of her mouth softened by the faint, purposeful suggestion of a smile. It was the dangerous smile of an adversary, but her eyes were coldly brilliant and veiled at once, like the eyes of an adversary who fully intends to fight, but hopes to lose. "Very well," she said. "I shall charge you for your room and board. It is against our rules to provide the unearned sustenance of another human being. Some of us have wives and children, but there is a mutual trade involved in that, and a mutual payment." He glanced at her. "Of a kind I am not entitled to collect. So I shall charge you 50 cents a day, and you will pay me when you accept the amount that lies in your name at the Mulligan Bank. If you don't accept the account, Mulligan will charge your debt against it, and he will give me the money when I ask for it."
"I shall comply with your terms," she answered.
Her voice had the shrewd, confident, deliberating slowness of a trader. "But I shall not permit the use of that money for my debts."
"How else do you propose to comply?"
"I propose to earn my room and board."
"By what means?"
"By working."
"In what capacity?"
"In the capacity of your cook and housemaid." For the first time, she saw him take the shock of the unexpected, in a manner and with a violence she had not foreseen. It was only an explosion of laughter on his part, but he laughed as if he were hit beyond his defenses, much beyond the immediate meaning of her words. She felt that she had struck his past, tearing loose some memory and meaning of his own which she could not know. He laughed as if he were seeing some distant image, as if he were laughing in its face, as if this were his victory and hers. "If you will hire me," she said, her face severely polite, her tone harshly clear, impersonal, and businesslike, "I shall cook your meals, clean your house, do your laundry, and perform such other duties as are required of a servant, in exchange for my room, board, and such money as I will need for some items of clothing. I may be slightly handicapped by my injuries for the next few days, but that will not last, and I will be able to do the job fully."
"Is that what you want to do?" he asked.
"That is what I want to do," she answered, and stopped before she uttered the rest of the answer in her mind. "More than anything else in the world." He was still smiling. It was a smile of amusement, but it was as if amusement could be transmuted into some shining glory. "All right, Miss Taggart," he said, "I'll hire you." She inclined her head in a dryly formal acknowledgment. "Thank you.
I will pay you $10 a month, in addition to your room and board."
"Very well."
"I shall be the first man in this valley to hire a servant."
He got up, reached into his pocket, and threw a $5 gold piece down on the table.
"As advance on your wages," he said.
She was startled to discover, as her hand reached for the gold piece, that she felt the eager, desperate, tremulous hope of a young girl on her first job, the hope that she would be able to deserve it.
Yes, sir, she said, her eyes lowered.
Owen Kellogg arrived on the afternoon of her third day in the valley. She did not know which shocked him most. The sight of her standing on the edge of the airfield as he descended from the plane, the sight of her clothes, her delicate transparent blouse tailored by the most expensive shop in New York, and the wide cotton print skirt she had bought in the valley for 60 cents, her cane, her bandages, or the basket of groceries on her arm. He descended among a group of men. He saw her. He stopped, then ran to her, as if flung forward by some emotion so strong that, whatever its nature, it looked like terror. "Miss Taggart," he whispered, and said nothing else, while she laughed, trying to explain how she had come to beat him to his destination. He listened as if it were irrelevant, and then he uttered the thing from which he had to recover. "But we thought you were dead." "Who thought it?" "All of us. I mean, everybody in the outside world." Then she suddenly stopped smiling, while his voice began to recapture his story and his first sound of joy. "Miss Taggart, don't you remember? You told me to phone Winston, Colorado, and to tell them that you'd be there by noon of the next day. That was to be the day before yesterday, May 31st. But you did not reach Winston, and by late afternoon the news was on all the radios that you were lost in a plane crash somewhere in the Rocky Mountains." She nodded slowly, grasping the events she had not thought of considering. "I heard it aboard the Comet," he said, "at a small station in the middle of New Mexico. The conductor held us there for an hour while I helped him to check the story on long-distance phones. He was hit by the news just as I was. They all were, the train crew, the station agent, the switchmen. They huddled around me while I called the city rooms of newspapers in Denver and New York. We didn't learn much, only that you had left the Afton airfield just before dawn on May 31st, that you seemed to be following some stranger's plane, that the attendant had seen you go off southeast, and that nobody had seen you since, and that searching parties were combing the Rockies for the wreckage of your plane." She asked involuntarily, "Did the Comet reach San Francisco?" "I don't know. She was crawling north through Arizona when I gave up. There were too many delays, too many things going wrong, and a total confusion of orders. I got off and spent the night hitchhiking my way to Colorado, bumming rides on trucks, on buggies, on horse carts, to get there on time. To get to our meeting place, I mean. Where we gather for Midas's ferry plane to pick us up and bring us here." She started walking slowly up the path toward the car she had left in front of Hammond's grocery market. Kellogg followed. And when he spoke again, his voice dropped a little, slowing down with their steps, as if there were something they both wished to delay. "I got a job for Jeff Allen," he said. His voice had the peculiarly solemn tone proper for saying, "I have carried out your last will." "Your agent at Laurel grabbed him and put him to work the moment we got there. The agent needed every able-minded man he could find." They had reached the car, but she did not get in. "Miss Taggart, you weren't hurt badly, were you? Did you say you crashed, but it wasn't serious?" "No, not serious at all. I'll be able to get along without Mr. Mulligan's car by tomorrow, and in a day or two I won't need this thing either." She swung her cane and tossed it contemptuously into the car. They stood in silence. She was waiting. "The last long-distance call I made from that station in New Mexico," he said slowly, "was to Pennsylvania. I spoke to Hank Reardon. I told him everything I knew. He listened, and then there was a pause, and then he said, 'Thank you for calling me.'" Kellogg's eyes were lowered. He added, "I never want to hear that kind of pause again as long as I live." He raised his eyes to hers. There was no reproach in his glance, only the knowledge of that which he had not suspected when he heard her request, but had guessed since. "Thank you," she said, and threw the door of the car open. "Can I give you a lift? I have to get back and get dinner ready before my employer comes home." It was in the first moment of returning to Galt's house, of standing alone in the silent, sun-filled room, that she faced the full meaning of what she felt. She looked at the window, at the mountains barring the sky in the east. She thought of Hank Reardon as he sat at his desk now, 2,000 miles away, his face tightened into a retaining wall against agony, as it had been tightened under all his blows of all his years,
and she felt a desperate wish to fight his battle, to fight for him, for his past, for that tension of his face and the courage that fed it. As she wanted to fight for the comet that crawled by a last effort across a desert on a crumbling track,